This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Who is Maud Dixon is the tale of literary identity theft. And that's about all I can tell you, because when I spoke with Alexandra Andrews about her novel, I assured her that we would avoid plot spoilers. But that didn't stop us from talking about some of her characters, identity, her editing process, and the fact that Who is Maud Dixon is Hollywood bound. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation.
So, you know, when reading descriptions of your novel, Who is Maud Dixon, I have seen comparisons to Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley or Elena Ferrante, calling your novel a tale of literary identity theft. How do you like to describe your book? You know, how did you pitch it?
I would pitch it as a, you know, again, with the spoilers, it gets a little tricky because you're never sure how much to give away. But I would pitch it as, you know, it's about a young woman who's very ambitious. And she gets a job as the assistant to a world famous pseudonymous writer and basically decides to take a shortcut and steal her life.
And this woman, I want to mention her name is Florence, because I was reading a piece in the Wall Street Journal magazine where you said, on the face of it, Florence wants to be a writer, but what she really wants is significance. So can you talk to me about this idea? I mean, we're talking about Florence, but I feel like you could be talking, you know, about me. Do you think this is a common sentiment?
You know, it's sort of funny. I've talked to some people who feel this way and some people who don't, but I've always had this fear of living a life that didn't matter. And I wonder, I mean, I was sort of raised without religion and I don't sort of have that context, which is maybe part of it. But you just want a sense that your life has heft and weight. And I think your early 20s are sort of an odd time because a lot of people have been told growing up that they can be anything they want. They can do anything they want, which is just patently untrue. I mean, there are so many people held back, you know, for reasons beyond their control, talented people. And, you know, the world is not going to be full of firefighters and ballerinas. And I think it's your 20s when you sort of start to bump up against reality. And a lot of people resign themselves, and that sort of has a negative connotation, and I don't think it necessarily has to be negative. They just realize that they can find happiness and meaning in smaller ways, in, you know, church or community or family. But I really wanted to create this character who had this single-minded ambition, and nothing was going to distract her from it.
You're talking about this character with a lot of depth, and, you know, this was a literary mystery thriller, and I tend to not like books that bend over backwards to take you, you know, to take the reader down one path only to provide like a twist at the end that nobody saw coming. But I felt like you allowed the reader to join in the discovery with, you know, nuggets along the way so we could feel sleuth-like and almost even a little bit superior. And I'm assuming those winks and nods were for me. But how do you decide when you should, you know, put your cards into play and when you should hold them close to the vest?
Oh my gosh, you know what? It was so much just trial and error. You know, I'd never written fiction before. I'd certainly never written a novel before. So I was just sort of learning as I went along. And I just threw out so many drafts. I changed the plot a million times. And then once I'd finished a fairly presentable draft, I gave it to my husband, who's a writer and editor. My agent had wonderful suggestions as well. And it was good to have sort of another pair of eyes, because once you know the plot, you sort of can't unknow it. Who would say, you know, this is too obvious, or you need to plant more seeds earlier on. So I think it was helpful to just have like another set of eyes on it.
So you've worked as an editor and your husband is an editor. How was that editing process? Was there another editor working on it? And was it helpful or harmful to have your own editing experience?
Well, my editing experience was limited to investigative reporting and copywriting. So I have never edited fiction. The way I came to fiction was always just as a reader and as a lover of literature. You know, I actually thought early on in my career that I might want to become a book editor. And I decided reading was just something so precious to me. And it was something so personal and something I got such joy out of that I didn't want to turn it into something that could you know, be drudgery. Every job is drudgery at some point. So I mean, I think actually all that reading I've done over my life just gave me a bit of an instinct for how a narrative works, what the best narrative structure is, when to, you know, how to unfold dialogue, that sort of stuff. I mean, there were definitely, it was definitely a learning curve, but a lot of it was instinctual. And then I'm someone who can't show anybody my drafts. It horrifies me. So when I had a pretty presentable, you know, I don't know what I would call it, final draft, although it certainly didn't end up being final, I gave it to my husband, who was very, very gentle and kind and helpful. I mean, that could have really gone wrong, but he's good at what he does. He gave me great advice. My agent gave me fantastic advice. I mean, I really did a full edit with my agent. And then with my editor, Judy Klein at Little Brown, I went through it again. So yeah, there were a lot of versions. I think 24 is what I have on my computer.
Wow, that's interesting. I've never asked an author before how many versions they had, but I'm so glad you offered that. That's interesting. You know, I want to go back to, you know, a little bit ago, I mentioned that the book is a literary mystery thriller. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's really smart. Oh, I mean, Florence wasn't the only one you had Googling things. So I was hesitant to give it any labels like mystery or thriller. Do you think labels like that are helpful, or do you think they can be detrimental?
I mean, I guess I'd say both. I think there are certainly books that don't fit neatly into any category. You know, Graham Greene, you know, made this distinction between his entertainments and his literary fiction. But I mean, all of his novels feel, I mean, there's an element of suspense in all of them, and all of them have his, you know, beautiful sentences and beautiful characters. And even, you know, towards the end of his life, he himself admitted that the distinction was sort of arbitrary. So I think in a lot of ways, there's going to be a lot of gray area where books don't really, or straddle the line, which I think mine does. But, you know, from a commercial standpoint, you know, people need to sell books. I guess, you know, department stores don't put the dresses with the pants. I mean, I guess it makes sense. I don't know. I'm not so involved in that side of it. But there was certainly when my book went out to editors, I think, I mean, there is an odd way where my book feels a bit like two books grafted together. Yeah. The first part is a little bit more of a character study, and maybe a little bit more literary. And then the second half is more of a straight up thriller. And there were some editors who said, you know, lose the first half, let's get right to the thrills. There were other editors who, you know, thought build out these characters a little bit more. So it really went both ways. And in the end, I just sort of actually didn't do that much to it. I sort of, you know, stuck to my guns, and what we have is maybe a bit of a hybrid, but I hope an enjoyable one.
You know, I worked for 15 years at the independent bookstore here in Wichita.
Oh,
and,
did you?
And we had, you know, we had a fiction section, and then we had like a mystery thriller section. And a friend of mine owns a bookstore in Chicago, and he blends them together. He just does not believe in even having a separate mystery thriller section. And I got to thinking, well, if I were still at Watermark, where would I shelve this? And it would have been in fiction. It would have not been.
I appreciate that.
It was a really great read.
When the cover was being designed, there was, you know, a part of me that was, the first version I got was, it felt a little bit too thrillery to me. And I sort of wanted it to feel a bit more elevated.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, there are these, like, these markers that just signal immediately to the reader what type of book it is.
It's a fantastic, enjoyable read that does not need any other labels. Okay, so there is a point in the book when Florence is reflecting on silence, and she notes that the only break in silence that she is experiencing is when Helen is listening to opera music. And she says, if anything, opera was like a very noisy form of silence. So I'm curious about your own preferences. Like when you write, do you like music? Do you like silence? Do you like opera?
If I'm at home, I like silence. If I'm writing at a coffee shop, which of course I haven't done in over a year, I listen to Rainstorms on my headphones. Years and years ago, I bought a CD of Rainstorms.
Oh, fun.
It somehow made its way onto my computer. That's what I listened to.
Okay, so
In the book, Florence was thinking about what it means to assume a new identity. And she said it would be like getting a new organ where one would have to take anti-rejection drugs for the rest of their life. And so this analogy hit home with me a bit because my father was an organ recipient and it really got me thinking about it. So you've clearly thought about this more than I have. But it's one thing to, like, quote unquote, reinvent yourself, but to do so literally, I mean, it feels nearly impossible, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, I am someone who probably has spent too much time trying to change myself. To become less anxious, to become more patient, more kind, whatever. And it's really, really hard. I think there's like a certain whatever, you know, very stable part that just always takes over. And then I think that's why we're so drawn to these stories of radical reinvention. And, you know, my favorite part in movies is always the makeover montage when the music's playing. And then, you know, in the course of 2 minutes, you know, it's a new person. But yeah, I think, I mean, who hasn't dreamed about their life being a little bit better or, you know, their own self being a little bit better? It's really tempting and it's really difficult, which I think is why these stories of snap transitions are very, very compelling.
So Florence does not have a good relationship with her mother, Vera. And in the acknowledgments, you pointed out that Vera Darrow was not based on your mother, and you gave her an entire paragraph.
I was concerned about that.
You gave her an entire paragraph in those acknowledgments, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to give her a shout out, but also, you know, talk to me a little bit about Florence's relationship with Vera, if you don't mind.
No, of course not. Yeah, I'll give a shout out to my mother, Lindy Common. I'm sitting on her couch right now, although she's not here, and I'm not sure she knows it. I think since becoming a mother myself, you see how you can love this other person so, so, so much, and then just completely have to accept who they are. And even if that's different from what you thought you were getting, it's even if it's different from you, you just have to love them for who they are. And I think that's really where Vera falls short. I think she does love Florence in her own way, but she really wants her to conform to her idea of a perfect daughter. And so when she's complimenting Florence or trying to seem supportive, she's just not seeing her. And I think Florence is ultimately taking that as an insult and deeply hurtful. At the same time, she has to put on this mask of being appreciative for this affection.
Okay, so I understand this story is Hollywood bound.
Yes, I hope so. Yes. Well, yes, it is.
So what's that experience been like?
Oh my gosh, it's just been so surreal. At every point, I never even thought I would finish the book, and I didn't think I would sell it. Every point has just been phenomenal. But Amy Pascal and a team at Universal have, you know, I can't even remember the right term, optioned. Mm-hmm. Well, whatever, I just won't even say it.
Okay.
And they have just a terrific team. They have Liz Hanna as the writer and the director. She wrote the screenplay for The Post, and I'm just thrilled with that choice. I mean, first of all, it had to be a woman, and I think Liz just really understands these characters really well.
So you've worked as an editor, a copywriter, a graphic designer, a journalist. It seems like you're quite the Renaissance woman. So what's next for you?
That's one way to put it. What's next for me? I mean, in theory, I'm working on my second novel. In reality, I'm finding it so difficult. I don't know. You know, I hear a lot of people have trouble with the second novel. I don't know if it's that. I don't know if it's the pandemic. I don't know if it's motherhood, but it's just, I'm having a lot of problems concentrating. Tell me it's not just me, but I'm hoping we're going to get there slowly but surely.
Every single thing you listed is completely valid. And to have all three at once, I mean, I wouldn't be able to do it at all. That was Alexandra Andrews, author of the novel, Who is Maude Dixon?, which was published by Little Brown. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and our producer is Haley Krausen. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.